Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the theatre of the absurd in the U.S. Senate, with Majority Leader Mitch McConnell cravenly doing Trump's bidding, putting forth bills laced with anti-immigrant poison pills inserted by the White House Rasputin Stephen Miller, which the Democrats will surely reject. Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working on the senior staff in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, and is the author of The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of the Shadow Government, joins us to discuss his article at Common Dreams, Is Mike Pence as Unfit for Office as Trump? We will look into Trump's phony offer of a compromise to open up the government with more obstacles for dreamers and further restrictions on asylum seekers, indicating that Trump cannot make actual concessions to Democrats to find a way out of this impasse for fear of losing the Sean Hannity and Coulter crowd, who will split the shrinking pro-Trump coalition on the far right that holds his base together. And since this crisis president creates crises instead of governing, because he's incapable of the latter, and as a reality TV showman only knows how to do the former, the chaos will continue, with the public and the press constantly manipulated by manufactured crises and distracted by cheap dramatics and tiresome stunts. Then we will get a comprehensive analysis of the major issue of our time, and that is how to restore a national consensus on what is true and what is real in this Trump era of fake news, as an endless stream of lies issue forth from our post-truth president. Gordon Pennycook, a member of the editorial board of Thinking and Reasoning and a consulting editor for Judgment and Decision Making, joins us along with David Rand, a professor of management science and brain and cognitive sciences at MIT, where he's the director of the Human Cooperation Laboratory and the Applied Cooperation Team. Together, they are the co-authors of an op-ed at the New York Times, Why Do People Fall for Fake News? Are they blinded by their social passions, or are they just intellectually lazy? We'll discuss what can be done to encourage critical thinking and curtail politically charged misinformation. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. And he has an article at Common Dreams, Is Pence as Unfit for Office as Trump? Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Good to be here.
Well, Mike, I want to talk to you about Pence, because my sense is that all of this talk about impeaching Trump and getting rid of Trump and all of the anger and angst on the political left about this dreadful president that's driving people crazy and they just can't wait to get rid of him, I think they ought to bracket the two of them together, frankly. I think they're two peas in a pod. I think the focus should be on getting rid of both of them. And of course, if that were the case, we'd end up with Nancy Pelosi, who seems at the moment to be a kind of a breath of fresh air.
Well, yes, that's right. And in some respects, you could even say Pence is worse. Donald Trump does not like having smokers around him and understands at least that tobacco is bad. Mike Pence has spent his entire career as a servitor of big tobacco. He was an owner in a family business of convenience stores in Indiana that was called, wait for it, Tobacco Road. He denounced a settlement between big tobacco and its victims as some big government plot against America, and so forth. He voted against a tobacco cessation measure in 2009, one of the relatively few House members to vote against it. It was a bipartisan measure. So he's got that. Also, that little belief in Armageddon. Trump doesn't believe in anything but himself. But if you believe in the apocalypse, it's pretty scary to put that person in charge of the nuclear button.
Well, you have to add to these end of times, they call them Christian Zionists, that basically love the state of Israel because they want Israel to begin Armageddon, so that you and I and everybody we know, Mike Lofkin, end up in the lake of fire in burning flesh while they all get raptured up to heaven. Well, guess who also believes in the rapture, along with Mike Pence? Mike Pompeo.
Yes, that's a rather shocking thing for a supposedly worldly Secretary of State. And having him doing the negotiations is not something that's very comforting. That's all I can say about that.
Right. Well, today, of course, we're witnessing this phony drama, this tawdry theater of the absurd at the U.S. Senate. As I mentioned in the opening, Mitch McConnell's cravingly doing Trump's bidding, and they're putting forth all these bills laced with anti-immigrant poison pills inserted by the White House, Rasputin, Stephen Miller. Now, and then, of course, there's two bills. The Democrats will surely reject the first, and the Republicans will surely reject the second. So, of course, in your book, Mike, the party is over, how Republicans went crazy, Democrats became useless, and the middle class got shafted. It seems like you're going to have to redo that. I mean, that title's almost tame compared to what we're seeing, although the Democrats, for a change, aren't being useless. Things seem to have improved markedly with the arrival of Pelosi and the majority of Democrats in the House.
Well, that's true, because I think they know if they fold on this one, Trump will use every funding issue as a way to extort something out of them. I mean, after all, he had already agreed in principle to everything in the continuing resolution, which would have funded the rest of the government. And then he had all these talk show jihadists basically talk him out of it. So they can't really trust his word. They're not, I don't think, very well advised to fall for something, particularly if it has all those poison pills in it. And it's for something that's rather stupid anyway. I would tend to disagree with some of the Democrats' messaging when Nancy Pelosi says the wall is an immorality. She may be speaking to people who believe that in the Democratic Party. It's not going to persuade the Republicans, and it may not persuade the independents. You need something harder-headed than that, but which is equally valid. Namely, one could invoke Trump's supposed hero, General George Patton, who said that fixed fortifications are a monument to the stupidity of man. And he certainly knew what he was talking about, because he was a general in the era when the Germans simply swept past the Maginot Line. And all fixed installations like that have the same vulnerability. A rare Republican who knows what he's talking about, and he's probably even more rare because I believe he's the only black Republican in the House Republican Conference, Will Hurd, basically gave an interview on NPR when he said, you only need a barrier like that on a handful of miles on a 1,800 or 2,000 mile extent of the border, and most of the drugs, for instance, come through legal ports of entry. And the notion that you need a wall as opposed to a response from people, because the Border Patrol sometimes can't respond for hours or even up to a day. What good does it do if you have a wall there that's 30 foot high? You'll have somebody who has a 31 foot ladder.
Well, I think in general, the Democrats, you know, they talk about the need for comprehensive immigration reform, but they really haven't spelled it out. And I think they do underestimate how much of America, I think the majority of Americans, are not happy with what they consider to be open borders, even though there's no such thing. So,
they need to convince people and have them understand that this crisis is mostly artificial,
mm-hmm.
that illegal immigration has been declining for years.
Well,
it may be a problem, but it is not a crisis. If it were a crisis, it would have peaked about 10 years ago.
Right. But the point I'm making is that I think Democrats underestimate how much the issue of immigration bothers a majority of Americans, and largely through misinformation.
And that's why they need to try to educate
right.
them in very simple terms, not moralistic,
mm-hmm.
But simply informational about what the numbers are, do walls work, and that sort of thing.
Right. But conversely, Trump overestimates how much the American people are concerned about border issues. So that seems to be the paradox here.
Oh, no question. He overestimated it in the last election and got beat.
So, again, I'm speaking with Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate Budget Committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. And he has an article at Common Dreams, Is Pence as Unfit for Office as Trump? Now, Pence, of course, addressed the Venezuelan people who there were vast demonstrations, and President Trump recognized the president of the National Assembly as the new head of state, as of a number of South American countries. And of course, Juan Guaido himself has declared himself the interim president. But Pence sent down a video message, which with really pretty bad Spanish, not that I'm in any way fluent myself, but you know, the way that Trump and Pence just appear on the world scene, I mean, how can anybody take this guy seriously? You see him with Trump. I don't know whether you've seen that amazing scene where they're in a cabinet meeting and Trump picks up a bottle of water on the table and puts it aside, and then Pence does the same thing. It's this a kind of robotic extension that...
Well, that's right. I mean, it's said in the Bible, which... Pence is given to quoting so much, I believe it's Matthew 6:24, that no man can serve two masters. Well, Mike Pence is doing a pretty good job of it, serving Trump just as he served Big Tobacco and served the Koch brothers, which was revealed by the excellent investigative journalism of Jane Mayer at the New Yorker. Basically, if you need somebody to get on a plane at taxpayer expense, both for the plane and for the Secret Service protection, go to an NFL game, greatly inconvenience the 50,000 fans with the security checks, and then demonstratively walk out 2 minutes into the game to protest something. Well, Mike Pence is your man.
Well, what's the story, though, with their so-called religiosity? And Betsy DeVos is another one. And by the way, Pompeo is also a protege of the Kochs. What is going on with the Kochs? Do they just want these faithful servants? because I don't see them as being particularly religious, the Kochs. I think they're quite, their only religion is libertarianism and accruing money. So are these guys just essentially Pompeo and Pence just hirelings of the plutocrats?
Well, essentially they are, and probably the Kochs realize that people of this sort of mental makeup tend to be very much authoritarian followers who will follow authoritarian figures like the Kochs, particularly if they're dispensing money.
Well, the idea, though, that if indeed Trump has a meltdown, and I don't think that's, I've often suggested that we may end up with Trump being like Howard Beale, just having a public meltdown, and instead of saying, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore, he'll just rant and rave. And apparently that's what he does in private all the time. The public doesn't see the real Trump, but everybody around him does. And, you know, more and more evidence comes out, and one wishes that the American people would get a glimpse into who this man really is and how he really behaves. But assuming at some point or other the 25th Amendment comes into play, and that would have to be engineered by Pence, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, the day after Trump was inaugurated, millions of women showed up around the country and around the world in protest. My God, if Trump becomes the president, it won't be like Gerald Ford. There won't be a breath of breathing a sigh of relief. Won't there be an extraordinary outpouring of alarm with women in this country taking to the streets?
Well, I would think so, given that the incumbent president at that point would be someone who wants to criminalize contraception. However, a very clever scholar named Michael Glennon wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post yesterday, I believe that was Tuesday, saying essentially with his reading of the 12th Amendment, both men were on the same ticket. The founders did not intend that the vice president should benefit from the fruit of the poison tree. If Trump was an illegitimate president, so is his vice president.
Well, he was, apparently Trump wanted Chris Christie, and but then, of course, Jared torpedoed.
But Jared Kushner did not want Chris
Right, because he put his father in jail. But it seems pretty obvious to me that what happened there was that Trump was basically told, you'll never make it. No Republican candidate will ever make it to the presidency unless he's got the religious right backing him.
And my understanding is that Pence was a pick of Manafort, Paul Manafort.
Well, he's a good Christian.
You know, which makes sense.
Right.
And we have to consider, too, that Pence was basically in charge of the transition. He could not have been in a position not to know what Michael Flynn was doing and all those covert contacts with the Russians. He's been basically left off the hook by the media on the whole Russia investigation, but I'm sure there's a lot more there than meets the eye.
So, apart from the fact that he's scary as hell because of his religiosity and the zealous nature, we learned that his wife teaches at a school that bans LGBT students and teachers. So that, you know, the Handmaid's Tale comes up all the time in reference to him. And we know that he's a coke whore, if I can use that blunt term. So what is your biggest objection in terms of your article, is Pence as unfit for office as Trump?
Well, he's basically incompetent. As I think I demonstrated in that article, to talk about defeating ISIS when, in fact, that was the very day, in fact, an hour before the speech commenced, and he should have known that four Americans were killed and ISIS claimed responsibility. He's incompetent. He's a sycophant. He's in hock to Big Tobacco, to the Koch brothers, basically the corporate America in some. And I think his ideas are mainly reactionary.
So just in closing, Mike, do you think I mentioned what happened when Nixon resigned and Gerry Ford took over? There was sort of a sigh of relief because Gerry Ford was a sort of, you know, brick from the Midwest, a solid-looking guy. You know, Pence has that sort of outward appearance, but Gerald Ford was a decent guy. He wasn't a wowser and a zealot. What do you think the reaction's going to be to a Pence presidency, not just from the women, but from American general? Will we be so happy to see the end of Trump that we'll accept this guy?
I don't think so. I think most people, if they oppose Trump, they definitely see through Pence.
Well, Mike Lofgren, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Good to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. And he has an article at Common Dreams, Is Pence as Unfit for Office as Trump? We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with a comprehensive analysis of the major issue of our time, and that is how to restore a national consensus on what is true and what is real. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Gordon Pennycook, who is a professor at the Hill and Levine Schools of Business at the University of Regina in Saskatchewan, Canada, as well as a member of the editorial board of Thinking and Reasoning and a consultant editor for Judgment and Decision Making. And also joining us is David Rand, a professor of Management Science and Brain and Cognitive Sciences at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, an affiliate of the MIT Institute for Data Systems and Society, and the director of the Human Cooperation Laboratory and the Applied Cooperation Team. They are the co-authors of an op-ed at the New York Times, Why Do People Fall for Fake News? Are they blinded by their political passions, or are they just intellectually lazy? Welcome to Background Briefing, Gordon Pennycook and David Rand.
Thank you.
So let me begin.
Great to be here.
Thank you, David. Let me begin with Gordon. Quite often in politics, there's this expression used, emotional intelligence, to suggest that somehow the Democrats are too wonky, whereas the Republicans are, and Donald Trump being a kind of example of this thesis, where the Republicans use emotional intelligence that's far more effective in politics. So what would your definition of emotional intelligence be?
Well, I'm not a big proponent of the emotional intelligence. I mean, I think part of the problem is the use of the word intelligence in that. I'm not sure that it's a kind of stable individual difference in that sort of way, not like intelligence. But I guess the broader point is that certainly it's the case that some politicians have a better sense of what will rouse the interests and sometimes, say, fears of the population. And the thing that we're kind of interested in is the extent to which people are intuitive, whether they kind of rely on their gut feelings when they make judgments. And it might be, and we don't really have direct evidence for this, but it's something we're looking into, it might be the case that politicians who are more intuitive draw more intuitive individuals, you know, from the population. So that is, if you speak in a simple kind of sort of way, you don't use too many flowery language, and you produce ideas that are like concrete, like the wall, for example, is a kind of intuitive thing. The wall keeps people out, you know, and then whatever the kind of vagaries of whether it's going to be effective and like what's the actual like cost of having to build a wall across the border, these are kind of secondary things, but the wall is a very kind of strong image that you can draw, and so that might have an influence on a particular type of people who have a more kind of intuitive outset. But, you know, again, that's still speculation from our point.
We actually have run a couple of studies on that with a grad student named Kyle Payton, where we did these experiments. We described a hypothetical candidate who, you know, had varied on all different kinds of dimensions, like having to do with their prior experience and education and things like that. But then we ascribed to one of them, quote, there was a lightly edited Trump quote about how they always go with their gut and they, you know, don't stop and think carefully about things. Whereas the other one is described with a quote saying, you know, things are always more complicated than they seem, and it's more important. It's really important to stop and think, and so on. And then we ask, which candidate would you prefer? And we find, consistent with the idea that Gord is suggesting, that the people who are themselves more intuitive, that is more inclined to just go with their gut, have more of a preference for the candidate that describes themselves as just going with their gut. So there is this kind of matching on cognitive style where intuitive people like intuitive candidates more than deliberative people do. And also a similar thing on issues, like these signature Trump issues, like building the wall along the, you know, the southern border. People that are more intuitive, even among Republicans, sort of more intuitive Republicans, like the idea of the wall more than deliberative Republicans.
And that's David Rand. And let me continue with you for a minute, David. What is the connection then between your studies and the extraordinary phenomenon of the number of lies that issue forth from Donald Trump? I mean, a lot of cynics have always said that politicians lie. That's not exactly a newsflash. But to do it so systemically and consistently is certainly a new twist. So in the context of the overall challenge for the United States, arguably the lone superpower, but the idea that this nation cannot agree, doesn't have a consensus on what is true and what is real, and more of it, citizens in the United States are doing what they call reality shopping, where they find their own truths. My sense is that we're dangerously unmoored and we're heading in the wrong direction. I take it from your op-ed that you agree with that, but give me a sense of how much Donald Trump is leading this phenomenon, or is he basically capitalizing out of this phenomenon?
I mean, I guess there's a lot to unpack in there. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I don't know that you know, research that is existing can say the extent to which Trump is the cause of this or the result of it, because, you know, it's just it's very hard to tease those things apart. But he certainly does seem to be tapping into some moment in the collective national psyche right now. But I don't know. I think the question of why people, a lot of Republicans in particular, don't seem to mind the fact that Trump is lying all the time is something that's a really interesting question. One possible explanation that's been put together by, or it's been put forth by some sociologists, is that the fact that Trump just kind of blatantly lies seems attractive to his base because it's challenging this norm of truth telling, which is like an establishment sort of thing. And so by obviously lying, that's a way of him challenging the establishment. And another possibility is, you know, I feel like a natural feeling that a lot of people had on the left was, wow, Trump is such a hypocrite because he's now advocating for all these things that he used to say he didn't care about, and say he doesn't care about all these things that he used to say he cared about, and so on. He seems totally sort of opportunistic and inconsistent. But it seems like the people on a lot of people on the right don't see him as a hypocrite and don't really have much issue with it. And one idea about why that might be is with this student, Jillian Jordan of mine. She's put forth this idea that a lot of the reason that we don't like hypocrites is because we feel like they're trying to falsely get credit for being good. So, like, if I condemn some bad behavior, that signals that I wouldn't engage in that behavior and gives me some kind of reputational benefit. And so then later, if you find out that I actually did engage in that behavior, you get mad because you feel like I was implicitly like lying in order to get a good reputation. And my guess is that doesn't really apply to Trump because he's such a blatant liar that just nobody really believes anything that he says that seriously. And so he doesn't really seem like he's trying to trick people with his lies because he's just so obviously lying all the time.
And Gordon Pennicook, what do you think of whether this Trump is capitalizing on this new kind of environment in which the truth is a moving target and he who spins the truth the most effectively wins the argument, or is he capitalizing on it, or has it been around before him?
Well, I think it's, like Dave said, it's hard to say if it's Trump's fault or not, if he's the source of the consequence of it. Mm-hmm. But I think one other thing that's missing from what Dave said is that it could be that people just don't believe that he's saying falsehoods. I mean, the thing of caring about the truth is one thing. Caring about what I believe to be true is another thing. And so if people don't care to assess their own beliefs according to evidence, then they don't care to assess what Donald Trump says according to evidence, so long as they can comport with what they believe. And so if he's saying things that are, you know, you say ideologically consistent or whatever, then that's true. Like, it doesn't matter if it's true in the world, but if I agree with you, therefore that is true under the perspective that truth does not have to kind of comport with evidence. Truth is just whatever I believe. And so that is, I think, instead of Trump causing that, I think what's happened is that we're just now seeing the extent to which this common kind of approach to truth is actually common. I mean, it's also the way that people approach religion, for example. And so this is not something that is totally new. It's just Trump is now stretching us to, and this is why it's such a outrage for journalists and for academics and scientists and so on, because our job is to care about the truth. And so now we are being confronted with this possibility that maybe people don't care about it as much as we do.
And again, I'm speaking with Gordon Pennicook, who's a professor at the Hill and Levine Schools of Business at the University of Regina in Saskatchewan, Canada, as well as a member of the editorial board of Thinking and Reasoning and a consultant editor for Judgment and Decision Making. And also joining us is David Rand, a professor of Management Science and Brain and Cognitive Sciences at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the director of the Human Cooperation Laboratory and the Applied Cooperation Team. So David, Gordon just mentioned religion, and I guess to some extent religion gives people comfort from the sort of difficulty, if not the agony, of having to sort of think your way through the complications of life and politics, etc. So to what extent is this permission, if you will, that people have now with this phenomenon of reality shopping? You know, you've got Christians getting their information from Christian television and broadcasting, liberals here in the United States from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox. And there's a sense that people now feel entitled to have their own beliefs. I mean, there was that famous remark by Senator Moynihan, you know, you're entitled to your own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts. Well, those days seem to be over.
Yeah, the link between between believing misinformation and fake news and religious beliefs is a very interesting one, and it's one that Gordon and I actually have a paper about, and that we each have been doing research for a long time on the relationship between cognitive style, you know, in reliance and intuition versus deliberation, and religious belief. And in some sense, you could think of our work on fake news and misinformation as an outgrowth of our prior work on religious belief. And so we have one paper that shows that sort of along the lines of what you're suggesting, people who are religious fundamentalists are more likely to fall for fake news, regardless of its political leanings. And also people that are more sort of dogmatic are more likely to fall for fake news. And there's also presenting evidence that that's because the religious fundamentalists are more likely to just rely on their intuition and less likely to stop and think and challenge what they're reading. But the obvious question that would arise from that is it the case that being raised in a religious context teaches you to just rely on your intuition and not stop and think about things? We have data that suggests that that's not actually the case. From an old 2012 paper of this result, and then we have replicated it more recently, which is that if you look at how religious people's families were when they were growing up, that is not related to how much they rely on critical thinking and reasoning. What is related to how much they rely on critical thinking and reasoning is how their religious beliefs have changed since childhood. So intuitive people have tended to become more religious since childhood, and reflective people or deliberative people have tended to become more atheist since childhood. And so it suggests that rather than this being an issue of religious training or upbringing, it's basically people who as adults are religious are just more likely to be intuitive people. And the religious, the deliberative people wind up sort of losing their faith. And so the core concept that's sort of driving the relationship between religious fundamentalism and falling for fake news is this basic cognitive predisposition. So people that are more deliberative are less likely to be religious fundamentalists and less likely to fall for fake news.
And Gordon Pennycook, does this come down to the notion that magical thinking and being a fabulist is actually, I guess, easier, if not more pleasant, than being a skeptic and being somebody like a journalist, for example? You know, you're not supposed to believe the first thing you're told. You know, you're supposed to sort of search for the truth, and quite often it's painful and unpleasant.
That's an interesting question. It's hard to say. Actually, we don't know right now if it's about how much people enjoy the things, but it could be just the way that you're used to thinking. You know what I mean? It might be a harder life if ignorance is bliss, I guess you could say. But for someone who is, for whatever reason, driven by looking for evidence and finding the truth, maybe for them that's what brings them bliss. Or maybe bliss has nothing to do with it. Maybe it's just that they learn to do that, and that's how they interact with the world. And you know, whatever people learn to do when they when they spend their time thinking, or if they don't spend their time thinking at all, as they're like, you know, children and go into adolescence, that's what we find enjoyment out of. Actually, I don't even know if there's any research on that. Maybe Dave knows, but yeah, it's an interesting supposition.
Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Gordon Pennycook and David Rand.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No, it's your head.
Oh, yeah.
And again, we are speaking with Gordon Pennycook, a professor at the Hill and Levine School of Business at the University of Regina in Saskatchewan, Canada, and David Rand, a professor of Management Science and Brain and Cognitive Sciences at MIT. Well, my sense is, though, that things are getting worse in terms of, as I mentioned, just in the broader context, you know, one wonders how we as a country can thrive, if not survive, with no consensus about what is true and what is real. And it seems to be what is muddying the waters even further is the fact that social media and these companies like Alphabet and Facebook and Microsoft, etc., are the biggest corporations now in the world. So that reflects how much influence they have. Facebook, of course, came in for a lot of criticism since the elections about propagating fake news and Russian fake news. But an interesting study was just done on who was most susceptible to Facebook's fake news. And it turns out that on the average, American Facebook users aged 65 and older posted 7 times as many articles from fake news websites as adults 29 and younger, according to this study, which was published Wednesday in Science Advances. So what do you make of that, David Rand?
It's a very interesting result, and we've talked a bunch to the authors of that paper. I think that it's very hard to do those kinds of studies where you try and quantify the amount of like fake news that different people were consuming, because having a like complete list of fake news websites is very difficult. Because unlike sort of mainstream or even a lot of hyper-partisan outlets that are like build a reputation and maintain a stable sort of brand and therefore are easy to track, the fake news sites are often changing names, shutting down, reopening. And so having a good comprehensive list of the amount of fake news that people saw is difficult. And so I feel like we should take results like those with a grain of salt. But be that as it may, the results are interesting. And in particular, they're interesting because those results are about what people shared. So it's like, so they're saying people 65 plus were much more likely to share fake news. But we don't know what people read, and we also don't know what people believed. And when Gordon and I started doing research in this domain, we sort of assumed that whether somebody believed something to be true or not was a major driver of whether they shared it or not, which seems, I think, pretty intuitive that we know, yeah, people share things they believe. But we've subsequently done a bunch of studies where we show people a series of headlines and we say, you know, would you share this on social media or not? And what we find is that how true or false a story is, it has a lot to do with how accurate people rate the story as. So if you ask them, is this true or false, people are actually pretty good at telling the true stories from the false stories. But if instead you ask them, would you share this on social media or not, their sharing decisions have very little to do with the truth of the headline. And so it's quite possible that the older people just have a different understanding of how to interact with social media. And it's not that they're worse, that they're more likely to fall for the stories. It could just be that they're more likely to share them. And in our data on accuracy, we actually find that if you ask someone, you know, how accurate is this headline, that the older people actually do better than the younger people. So I think reconciling those results with the paper by that you're talking about by Andy Geth and colleagues is a sort of open question.
Well, Gordon Pennycook, one of the things that's alarming about the Russian interference is that in many ways what Putin has developed in the former Soviet Union in Russia today, with the help of his political technologist, Surkov, a former theater director, who's come up with this idea, which was a very good book was written about it, titled Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. The idea that you just throw out all kinds of even conflicting propaganda, keep people off balance. And it's certainly working for him. And to some extent, we do have a kind of Pravda, if you will, with Fox News in this country that is certainly dedicated to the Republican Party and to Donald Trump in terms of being consistent propagandists. And a lot of people are puzzled by the so-called base. and what keeps them hermetically sealed in this bubble of delusion where they're impervious to facts and evidence. And that seems to be the way it is. So we always think of ourselves as having the free press and not being susceptible to propaganda, but propaganda obviously worked in the former Soviet Union and works still today in China. And so how much do you think that is just the issue, you know, going back to George Orwell's 1984, that propaganda itself is incredibly effective and that we have lost, to some extent, the critical thinking to distinguish propaganda from what we consider to be in the news?
It's a huge issue, absolutely. I mean, that is the way that people's beliefs are formed about politics is not similar at all to the way that it's formed for, you know, for example, journalists. Because people have day jobs, right? They go to work. They might watch Fox News for a while in the evening or MSN or whatever. And that's the kind of, you know, they're not spending all their time trying to figure out these issues. They have actual problems to deal with, all of us do, of course, other things that go on in their lives. And then politics is this other thing. The other kind of element of that, which is important, is that news is entertainment, right? That is the part of the problem with social media, for example, is that when you go on Facebook, it's, you know, it's not just news stories. It's actually, you know, videos of dogs and babies and stuff, or posts from your friends, and then a news article. That's not the kind of mindset you'd be taking when you're looking at news. You have to be thinking about it in a more critical sort of way. But it's way too easy to just not do that, to just think about news as entertainment and to carry on just believing whatever kind of feels right to you. And so the one study that Dave and I did, well, a set of experiments really, that kind of ties into this, is that we found that if you present people a fake news headline, once before, people will later believe it more, be more likely to believe it's true. That is, a single prior exposure to like a fake news headline makes it seem more plausible later on. So even if people aren't really paying attention to what they're reading, it does have an influence on what they believe. And so in that kind of sense, our kind of feelings about politics will be pushed around. Of course, it doesn't mean that most people will vote the same way no matter what happens. But our kind of sense of what's happening in the political world gets shifted around quite easily because our particular beliefs about, you know, what is advisable is not set in anything apart from what we happen to be seeing on TV or on the radio or whatever. So people are unfortunately malleable with that. And I don't think that there's any world in which we could expect people with other things going on to spend all our time dealing with these issues. And I don't actually have a solution for the problem apart from, you know, trying to expose more people to the idea that they have to be thinking more critically about what they see. But, you know, I don't even know if that works that well. Right now the field is kind of grappling with the issue, but we haven't gotten very far in terms of finding solutions.
Well, it obviously we all agree that it's probably the greatest challenge we face, try and reestablish some consensus about what is real and what is true. Going, you know, the last time that happened, I guess, consistently was when Uncle Walter Cronkite delivered the news. And then, of course, with the end of the Fairness Doctrine under President Reagan, the restraint on the news and the owners of the media back then, while the Fairness Doctrine operated, was that if you want to express political views and use your media asset as a private soapbox, you have to offer equal and opposite time to the opposing point of view. And that had the sense of dampening down the kind of extreme political speech which we now have become used to. But has there been, concurrent with that emergence of both the end of the Fairness Doctrine and the growth of social media, what has happened to our education system concurrently? Because it seems to me that there has to be a connection there between our failing education system and the erosion of critical thinking. So let me start with David on that.
I would start by saying that I think some of the work that Gord and I have been doing with some of our other co-authors suggests that it's not so much that people can't figure out what's true or false, or that people don't want to know it's true or false. But instead of either of those things, I think a lot of times people just kind of forget to think about it. And so we've been doing these experiments sort of nudging people to think about the concept of accuracy while they're on social media and finding that this does make them more discerning in the content that they share. And so I don't really think that people want to be post-truth. Like, I don't think that most people say, I don't care whether it's true or not. I just want it my way. I think that's more of a sort of subconscious thing. And if when they do explicitly stop and think about it, they don't want to be tricked or fooled, then they want they generally want to know the truth. And so I think much of the problem is about just like getting people to take advantage or to tap into that sort of latent desire and ability they have. So anyways, that's one thought. And then in terms of education, it's an interesting question, and it's something we've looked at a little bit in that, you know, in all these studies that we run, we always ask people about their education level. And so we do find that people that have higher education levels are better at the sort of cognitive reflection, critical thinking that we study, and therefore are also less likely to fall for fake news. But those effects are pretty small. And most importantly, the relationship between cognitive reflection and discerning false from true headlines that we find is totally unaffected by it's not about education. It's not that that is to the extent that more reflective people are more educated. That doesn't explain why more reflective people are better at telling fake from real news. If you include education as a control, it doesn't change the relationship between cognitive reflection and discerning the truth of news content at all. And that may say something about the nature of the educational system here, in terms of what people are being taught. But also it's tricky because people, you don't know what causes what. Like, is it that going to, so there's a correlation between cognitive reflection and education, but you don't know how much of that is because getting educated changes how reflective you are versus how much of that is people that are more reflective decide to get more education.
And Gordon Pennycook, a lot of people have argued that since they stopped teaching civics in high schools in the United States, that our political literacy has suffered. Could you make the same case then that, I mean, in other words, can critical thinking be taught like you can teach civics? Could you also teach critical thinking?
I think you definitely can. I mean, it's not easy to do, though, but that's what teaching someone to be a kind of scientist or like any kind of professional degree, it gets built into it. I think the issue is that it should be taught in the same way that math is taught in high school. That is, if we teach people about, I mean, math is about logic, so they're related, but the specific teaching people not just what to think, but how to think is, to me, the most important aspect of all education, and we don't have a dedicated class for it. I mean, some schools maybe do. I don't know exactly what everybody does, but it's not typically something that is taught. It's supposed to be something that's taught across kind of all courses, and it's used a lot as a kind of buzzword in education. You know, we teach critical thinking when we do history, blah, blah, blah. But really you want specific, actual research-based kind of work that does specifically that, and in my opinion, it's a bit lacking. Although, of course, I'm not an expert in education, but it's just I can tell from my experience and from other people telling me in education that this is something that's lacking. So that to me is the biggest thing.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, then let me start with David Rand. Are we heading into a more divided, less critical thinking environment here? You know, we mentioned how the country's leader, President Trump, has told some, 6,000 plus lies. Actually, it's a reporter up in Canada, or he's not in Canada, he's the Washington bureau chief for the Toronto Globe and Mail that's been collating all of this evidence of these blizzard of lies. So that's, I don't know whether a leader, good or bad, leads a country in a certain direction. But what's your sense of where we're heading and what can be done to arrest or, if not, reverse this lamentable trend?
I don't know. I mean, to me, the thing that seems the most concerning about Trump is what he's doing to the social norms about what is acceptable behavior. And again, it's hard to know whether there's been a change in social norms among the sort of populace, and the fact that Trump is being successful is reflecting that. And there probably is some of that, but I do think that having our leader, the sort of elected leader of the country, just be so flagrantly dishonest, I think that does have a real impact on people's understandings of what's acceptable behavior. Even people, that don't like Trump, there's this kind of subconscious, assimilation of the information that you're seeing and of the behavior that you're observing. And so I think that is, really potentially very long-term damaging. And I guess the thing that I hope is that Trump is so extreme that it is awakening in people a realization of like, oh, this actually is really bad, and we can't allow our country to go in this direction. So we're almost, I think it remains to be seen which thing is going to be stronger, that kind of direct influence on social norms or the kind of anti-Trumpian backlash that he is creating. And I certainly hope it's the latter.
A last word from you in terms of what is likely to arrest this trend or reverse this trend?
Yeah, so I would say that my hope would be for everyone listening to this that what they will take away from this first and foremost is just to have the idea of accuracy on their mind and to think them to be thinking to themselves, it's not a lost cause. We're not totally held captive by our partisan biases. And if we bother to stop and think about it, we actually have the ability most of the time to figure out what's true or not, and we have the inclination to not share bad information. And so my hope is for all of your listeners, when you finish this podcast and you go back to your or this show and you go back to your news feeds, that you'll be more likely to be thinking about accuracy. And when you see a headline, before you share it or before you just sort of say, okay, well, I guess that's true, stop and think about it for a minute. And when you see your friends posting things that, don't really make a lot of sense, you can yourself post, say, hey, we should all be thinking about accuracy. It's important to not be sharing bad content and so on and so forth, and try and yourself project a norm of caring about accuracy.
Well, David Rand, I thank you very much for joining us here today, and Gordon Pennycook.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Gordon Pennycook, who's a professor at the Hill and Levine Schools of Business at the University of Regina in Saskatchewan, Canada, as well as a member of the editorial board of Thinking and Reasoning and a consulting editor for Judgment and Decision Making. And also joining us was David Rand, a professor of Management Science and Brain and Cognitive Sciences at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and the director of the Human Cooperation Laboratory and the Applied Cooperation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.